that. 17 past 12. The open line is 8223 0000, and time to catch up with one of our friends of the show. It's Craig Isherwood from the Citizens Electoral Council. Hello, Craig.
G'day, Jeff.
Mate, we've been chatting for a while, and we may have chatted about this a couple of years ago, perhaps, but there'd be a fair turnover of audience and people listening that didn't hear us at that particular time. Thought, well, let's talk about Craig. Your background.
Right, okay.
Yeah, where did you come from, Craig? What's your background?
Well, I'm a West Australian who born and bred, who lived in Queensland for 12 years and then have been in Melbourne for the last 18.
Oh, it sounds like you've been on the run.
Well, I've been to the best states, I reckon.
Oh hello. Oh, that's fighting words.
Oh, no, but, Jeff, I'm the founder of the Citizens Electoral Council, a political party in this country 22 years ago.
Right.
My wife and I founded it with a few others.
Mm-hmm.
What we did was, this was the era back in just after the 1987 stock market crash. This was the era of a guy by the name of, I can't even remember, Peter Sawyer, I think his name was.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of ferment in the bush back in the Australian the Australia card debate, where the government wanted to bring out identity cards.
Oh, yes, I remember that, yeah.
It's very different going back then, because we're talking about the late 80s and we just had quite a lot of heavy deregulation of the entire Australian economies. We had interest rates at 18% to 19% on overdrafts, and you know, the economy was being smashed. And this was the policies of globalisation, free trade, economic rationalism. The whole works was starting to hit the Australian economy pretty hard. So in 1987, Joe Bjelke-Petersen was kicked out of being the Premier for 19 years in Queensland, and we just happened to live in Kingaroy, you know, peanut country.
Mm.
And we decided that we had to do something politically, because I was involved in agriculture at that time, growing small crops, and every time we tried to develop our technology using trace minerals, we hit a brick road in the brick wall in the agricultural department. They said, "Look, this is political. So let's do something political. Let's start a political party and stand a candidate against the National Party candidate for the seat of Barambah back in 1988." Now, this was a grassroots movement, and people were so enraged about what was going on. I mean, the change, the fact they didn't have a long-serving premier in their seat anymore. We actually mobilised a grassroots campaign around an issue called Citizens Initiated Referendum, which is what's used in by California and Arnie Schwarzenegger and these guys to, basically it's called the will of the people, where you know, you can vote up issues and the majority of the population say it's a good idea, then it becomes law.
Mm.
It's misused these days through large, you know, mass media propaganda campaigns and so forth, and it's not really we don't support that concept of government anymore. But back then, the grassroots campaign meant we actually swamped the entire electorate, and we got a Member of Parliament elected who later defected, of course, because that's the nature of these sorts of things, populist movements.
Yes.
And but however, the real motivation amongst the guys, you know, we who founded it, was this concept that we needed politicians that represented the actual national interests of the country. That national sovereignty was a major issue. The concept of the general welfare. Why don't politicians actually represent the people these days instead of the large corporate concerns, the banks, large multinational corporations? And we actually campaigned on that's why we started the. That's why we started the party.
I guess politics gets involved, Craig. I mean, what happens if they decide to... I know you're really big on national infrastructure projects and things like that. What happens if the government does decide to do something in the national interest and the national interest hates it, so they get voted out? I mean, that's when the real world hits and they go, well, I mean, politics has to be populist to a certain degree, otherwise you don't get around, you don't stay in power to do any good stuff.
Well, at the moment, the way the two-party political system is entrenched in this country, it's very difficult for any third voices to come up. And that's why we don't support compulsory preferential voting. We prefer optional preferential voting or even no preferential voting first past the post, so that people actually can go to the polls and vote who they want to without having to be forced into having to give preferences in the end to the two major parties.
Yep.
But when, look, people know... Individuals know what their national interests are, in the sense of decent health care, decent infrastructure, and you've got this debate raging right now of population control, because people say with our massive continent, 23 million people means we're overpopulated, which is an absolute pile of garbage. What we're seeing is the end phase of 40 years of this, the same policies that we were fighting back 22 years ago, of not developing our country in the inland and developing industries, shutting down farms, shutting down water projects, literally, and forcing a lot of farmers to the war. Now, I've called this genocide in terms of Australian industries and farmers and so forth, and that's what I'll be campaigning on in this particular federal election. The interesting part, back in 1988, actually in 89, I started a newspaper called The New Citizen, which we've just published a new edition of, which people can get from us at any time.
Mm-hmm.
I've been the editor of that since 1989. So that's been long running. We've printed tens of millions of copies of that and published it around the country. But really the problem came in 1990, where as a populist movement, we sort of ran out of steam. We really didn't have a philosophy. And while our philosophy of national sovereignty was very good and all that sort of thing, we really didn't know what we're doing. We're all greenhorns. And I actually then, through a series of coincidences, we met up with a fellow in the United States called Lyndon LaRouche, who he too was fighting against globalization, against these policies that have destroyed our country, and very much pro-national sovereignty. And I got to know him. I traveled to the United States, met up with his organization, and discovered his philosophy, which is the idea that human beings are not animals, and that economy has to do with developing the creative and productive powers of labor. That is, that human beings can make discoveries of how the universe works and then apply that through technology into the economy, and therefore increase the quality of life for all people. Now, that's his philosophy. It's the philosophy that I brought back and refounded the political party about 1991. And from then, we've been the only independent political party that is still around. I mean, we've seen many, many rural populist parties rise up and disappear, and they're usually single issue, or they've got, you know, populist support in the sense that they stoke up racist issues or immigration issues. But we're the only party that has actually stuck to our guns on every single issue and never diverted in 22 years. So that makes us rather a formidable policy organization, because we have policies on every aspect that comes back to our philosophical stance.
Mm. Now, because you've been around for so long, I mean, what that gives you an opportunity is to give yourself a track record to a certain degree, because a lot of people make big calls and big claims, but the fact that you've got longevity actually gives you the opportunity to see some of these things through.
That's right.
And I know we were talking 5-6 weeks ago, you were making some calls about Greece and the European banks, and the ABC News, they were just saying the same sort of thing yesterday.
You see, we're associated with LaRouche. He's the world's most renowned physical economist, which means he looks at physical economic processes, not money. How much infrastructure are we building? How are we funding our manufacturers? What industries are we creating? How's our farms? What are we actually producing? That's physical economy. And we are associated internationally with his organization, and he's made many forecasts since 1956 that actually come to pass because of the fact that he looks at the economy from a physical economic point of view. Now, he forecast 3 days before the global financial crisis hit that in fact was going to happen, and it wasn't to do with real estate prices and the housing market, and that's what we still say today.
Oh, he might be to blame, Craig, because he probably put the word out there, everyone went sell, and everything headed south. Now we know who to blame. Thank you for that, that's good.
But the problem is, and people can get their calculators and work it out, is what we've got in the world today is a monetary system where there's $1.4 quadrillion worth of debt in these things called derivatives. Now, I don't know people's eyes to glaze over, but derivatives are basically gambling debts, because what's taken place is that money is an idiot by itself. It's useful as a medium of exchange for real goods and services. However, under deregulation of the banking system internationally, since basically 1971 under Nixon, when he floated the US dollar and took it off the gold reserve standard, what happened is that money itself took on value. So you had money for money's sake, buy money, sell money, you know, money costs for money.
Mm.
Now, what's happened is you've had all this money floating around, and then you've had other instruments created by the former Federal Reserve Chairman, like Alan Greenspan, called derivatives, which are now bets on money. So you can bet on the value of money, and none of this has any real value. And over the period of the last 30 years, you've had more and more debt build up as more and more of these gambling debts build up in the system.
Do you know that's the best explanation of derivatives I've ever... Because this whole three-year process of the, you know, all the rigmarole we've gone through with the global financial crisis, and derivatives, like, it comes up all the time.
Yeah.
You just go, I've really got to know what that... Just one thing, Barack Obama, just in the last few days, has put forward some measures in the US... to rein the banks in and the big boys in a little bit, just to try and make sure this sort of thing never happens again. And I guess that's got something to do with derivatives as well. Can you explain what he's pushed through?
He actually forced the destruction of another element of that same bill put up by two senators who wanted to bring back what's called the Glass-Steagall provisions for the banking sector. Now, what happened in 1990s to really kick along this derivatives or this gambling system is that Bill Clinton repealed the Glass-Steagall bill, which was put in by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. And what it did is it says that commercial banks, your ordinary banks, are not allowed to use the depositors' funds to invest in speculative activity. You got investment banks are different. You know, that's where people can put their money in those investment banks, go and speculate in all sorts of
higher risk,
more tricky stuff, right?
Yep.
But once the Glass-Steagall was repealed and the deregulation was in full form, you had banks then allowed to use their depositors' funds to speculate literally on, like, gambling debts in these horrible instruments called collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps and all these fictitious instruments that have built up this massive debt. Now, the two senators in the United States wanted to put that in, and it was stonewalled by Harry Reid, the senator, the leader in the Senate, who actually called for what's called a cloture vote. In other words, he shut down the debate and shut down the moves to actually have that provision put in to bring back Glass-Steagall. Now, if that had happened, and this is why the stock markets reacted so badly, and particularly towards the end of last week, is that they thought that the Senate was going to pass this Glass-Steagall bill and cut off the gravy line, this gambling gravy line. And that's why the stock markets fell rather precipitously last week.
Okay.
But once they knew that Barack Obama had effectively twisted a number of arms in the Senate and this legislation was going to pass, the stock market rebounded before the vote was actually completed.
Mm. Now, Craig, I'm going to have to wrap it up, but a quick one, and just a yes or no. I know that'll be hard for you, but I just want a yes or no. The 40% super tax on the mining companies, good or bad?
Yes, good.
Good.
It's got nothing to do, Jeff, with the current period of global fluctuations. What's freaking the mining companies out and the entire system is these sovereign default problems of these countries in Greece. That's the big elephant under the carpet.
We'll talk about that next week, if you like. And Craig Isherwood, if people want to find out more.
Best thing is the website, www.cecaust.com.au. We're about to put our new citizen up there, which people should get, and otherwise have a look around on the website. And a lot of the material that I've covered, they can either send an email, ask about it, or find material on the website.
Right, terrific. Good to catch up, Craig. I'll catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
She's the open line, 8223-0000, if you want to make a comment.
5AA brings you the news as it happens. Live and local.